as excited as I am about the fact that we're about to enter into the journey that Luke describes of life with the adult Jesus. This is the first Sunday we meet him. He was born just a couple of weeks ago, right? And last week we had his dedication at the temple. Well, now here he is ready to be commissioned for ministry. And I think we take this scripture so much for granted that we don't realize how lucky we are that Luke took so seriously, and all the other gospel writers really took so seriously, the importance of writing down all of these stories about Jesus, trying to record some of the things he taught and many of the things he did and the things that happened to him so that we could have what Luke describes as a good accounting, so that we would understand who is this one who has come to be Messiah. Because even in the time that Luke lived, and even in the time before him where people actually had bodily encounters with the living Jesus, it wasn't easy for them to understand Jesus as Messiah. When we were talking as staff about these stories that Luke gives us as the account of Jesus to help us understand, it becomes really clear that the people who encountered Jesus didn't know who he was. Even John, who had come to proclaim him, didn't quite understand, "Are you the one?" And so it, we thought, was like those of us who are lay people trying to put together a Rubik's Cube puzzle. It seems impossible, and it gets really frustrating, and you get a sense of the people's frustrations in some of these stories. But I think even today we need to wrestle out exactly what does it mean that Jesus is the Messiah. We need to try to understand, why did he come? Clearly, he was expected, right? Especially for the Hebrew people, for the Israelite people. He'd been expected for generations. They've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and all the prophets had foretold that there would be a Messiah coming. And clearly, according to John, there are ways that people can prepare to receive the Messiah when the Messiah comes, but who is he? Could the Messiah really be this carpenter's son from Nazareth? Or who isn't he? He's not always who people expected. Here in this story, people are thinking maybe John's the Messiah. Well, no, John's not the Messiah, but John's got a role to play here. And what difference does it make that Jesus isn't the Messiah that people expected? And what difference does it make that Jesus is the Messiah at all? What difference does it make that the Messiah came? Did it make a difference or not? And maybe the most important question for us to wrestle with here and now is, as we learn more and more about Jesus through these accounts that have been gifted to us, what difference are we making? What are we doing to allow Jesus to come as Messiah into our lives? So, why did the Messiah come? Do we need a Messiah? As you think about that, I ask you just to think about your last week. What have you been reading? What have you been watching? What have you been thinking about? What have you been experiencing in your daily life? Some of you might know I was summoned to serve as a juror in St. Croix County this past week, and luck of the draw, my number came up, and on Wednesday I went to the courthouse and with about 40 other people. It seemed like a group about this size, actually, quite a few of us, and we got oriented to what the process would be. There was a trial that day, and they needed to pick jurors for the trial, and Then they took us upstairs to the courtroom and had us sit out in the court. And then they called 18 names. A jury is only 12 people, but they called 18 names as potential jurors. And so we all walked up and sat in the jury box. The jury box had 12 chairs only. And then in front of the jury box, there were six folding chairs. And from these 18 potential jurors, we would have a process of discovery known as voir dire. It's a French term meaning to speak truth, during which the judge and the attorneys are trying to determine if we 18 are fit to serve as impartial jurors on the trial. Because everyone in our country is entitled to a fair trial, and so the judge is trying to ensure that a fair trial will be administered for the plaintiffs who are bringing the case and the defendant. And so a series of questions starts, and the judge starts with questions like, do any of you know either of these attorneys after we'd been introduced? Do you know the plaintiffs? Do you have any prior relationship with any of these people? Do you have any prior relationship with the plaintiff's attorney's firm? Or with the insurance company that's the defendant in this case? And then, right away, one potential juror got dismissed because he had had a stroke recently, and even after they had given him some kind of amplification device, he still couldn't hear the judge's questions, so he wouldn't be able to make a good decision in this case if he couldn't hear the testimony, right? So he got dismissed. And another person was excused right away because he had a family member who was embroiled in some litigation with the plaintiff's attorney's firm. Then questions like, did any of us work for an insurance company or a healthcare company? And if we were raising our hands, if we had any of those experiences, we needed to describe what our particular roles were. Had any of us been injured because of the actions of another party? That was a very important question. Had any of us had a claim or a lawsuit related to an injury? And we had to tell those stories. The list of questions seemed to go on and on and on, like it was more important to do this voir dire than it was the trial itself, because we needed an impartial hearing. And then, after the judge was finished, the attorneys each had their turn, and when the plaintiff's attorney stood up, he really drilled down. He asked us that question again about had we been injured by the actions of another and made a claim, and people would raise their hands, and he wanted to know if they felt like the claim had been satisfactorily met. But he didn't stop just with us. He said, now think about, do you have family members or friends who have been injured parties where there was a claim or a lawsuit? And it was stunning. Out of 18 potential jurors, how many people had been impacted by personal injuries? Listen to this. One of our jurors, who was about my age, had been hit by a semi as a 16-year-old when he was riding his bike, and he was hospitalized for several weeks, and there was litigation following his accident and injury. Another one of the jurors had a potential brother-in-law, or had a brother-in-law, who was injured in a workplace accident in which he broke his back and never had fully recovered. Workers' compensation claim in that case. Another had an uncle who'd nearly died in a silo accident. He survived, but he lost both of his legs in the accident. Another lawsuit. A second-year college student on our jury had a friend whose car was hit by a train because the crossing gate failed to drop. The friend survived the accident, but he too lost both of his legs, and he's never been the same since. A young woman shared the story about how her father, a city employee, had sustained a head injury because someone had failed to properly seal a manhole cover. And as a city employee, he was plowing, and that manhole cover popped up with the force of the plow, hit him in the head, causing a brain injury that has never resolved. more claims. And finally, after you thought there cannot be anything else, there was one more hand that must have gone up behind me, and I didn't turn to look, but I heard this elderly woman's voice quaking as she told the story about her son back in his college days had been celebrating homecoming with friends, and she went on to tell the story at great length. And in the wee hours of the morning, he was driving friends home, but they were still under the influence. The car went off the road, ran into a tree, and his best friend was killed. More claims, but not just claims. We weren't in the realm of just talking about broken bodies. We were talking about broken spirits and broken lives and broken families and just this wake of devastation in just 18 people's lives. It was like World War II had occurred for them. So much suffering because of the actions of others. John's world apparently wasn't so much different. Through negligence and inattentiveness, people are hurt all the time. People make fatal mistakes. People lie. They cheat. They steal. They cut corners to save a buck or to earn a buck. They put finances before people. We don't usually think about the impact that we're going to have or that our actions are going to have on other people. Think about it. Do you, when you walk out of the house in the morning, think, who am I going to adversely affect today just by the fact that I'm in the world and claiming my space and maybe a little too much of my space? And yet, not one of us will get through life without being impacted by the actions of another. In John's day, clearly the people were unsettled in their lives, the way that many of us are unsettled in our lives when things don't go according to our plans. They were seeking something, coming out into the wilderness to find John, as if they thought this prophet in the wilderness would have something for them, some hope, some answers for why their lives weren't going the way they thought they were supposed to. But John doesn't give them any answers. John names the problem, and he names it pretty clearly. He's pretty harsh. He doesn't pull any punches. He names it to them. You are the problem. These people have been running into the wilderness for some panacea that John can't provide. They're trying to run away from the wrath that they rightfully deserve. Why? Because instead of yielding fruits worthy of repentant lives, they're yielding what John says is the fruit of vipers. It can translate that way. We say brood of vipers. It's the fruit of vipers. You're the fruit of vipers. And think about what kind of fruit do vipers yield, right? They strike. And then what? Death. These people who are coming out in pain are killing each other. It's their behavior that's causing society to break down and for it to be so awful. This self-centeredness that's running rampant has turned the world upside down, and nobody can trust anybody anymore. The ones who are supposed to serve and protect have become the ones most to be feared. That's why we need a Messiah. We need some help restoring the right order. We need justice to prevail so that the unprotected don't get trampled. But the interesting thing is, we don't just wait passively for the Messiah to come. No, John's message says there's work for us to do. There's preparation to get us ready to receive Messiah. And so, what preparation does John suggest? It's easy. Repent. Realize that it's not just about somebody else, but it's about you too who are causing the problems of our culture. You'll only be ready to receive the Messiah if you're ready to acknowledge your part in this mess that we're in together. Well, clearly that's not as easy as it sounds. When John told the people to repent, they looked at him and said, "Yeah, how?" But thankfully, John gave them some concretes to hang on to. What he suggests to them is a great starting place for us too. Surprising, but a good place to start. What does he say to them? He says, "Stop hoarding. If you have two coats, you have one more coat than you need. Give one away." And I'm sure Kay Keene could help us figure out some people who could use our extra coat. She's the director at Open Hands Midway, and I don't mean to burden you with this right now, but I bet if you brought those extra coats in, especially the really warm, furry ones next Sunday, I bet Kay could help us find some people who would be very grateful for a warm coat right about now. What else did he say? Take no more than you need. Each of us only need so much. Over my oatmeal this morning before I came to church, I pulled out, Lutheran Social Service had just sent out an annual report with, it was kind of a stewardship report, and I was reading profiles of some of the people that are supporting Lutheran Social Service's missions and ministries, and there was one couple in there, and the wife said, "You know, there comes a point in life where you have enough, and you don't need any more." And I think most of us have probably reached that point. And then, if you've gotten to the point where there's enough, what would happen if you didn't seek to have any more? How would it change you and make you perhaps more mindful of those around you, of the needs around you? Of course, Kay, in her work, she sees that. But what about the rest of us? Are we so caught up in our own needs for stuff that we miss a world of need that we could meet so easily out of the abundance that's been entrusted to us? And then the last thing he talks about is fostering contentment with what you have. How would your behavior change? How would your actions be different in the world if you let yourself be happy just the way things are right now? Those three things. And isn't it fascinating that the three things that John tells people to do to prepare for the coming of the Messiah are all about fostering contentment with having enough? I think it calls us who live in the most affluent time and place in all of history, probably, to think about where is our desire for more getting in the way of our relationships with one another and our relationships with God. Seriously, let's think about that. Not just think that's somebody else's problem, but think seriously about how is that a problem in my life? Because we also can prepare the way for the Messiah by fostering contentment and generous hearts. If you haven't already read it, I commend to you an article that Tom Bulger wrote or kind of crafted for us. It came to you by email from Redeemer on January 1st. The title of the article was "A New Year's Resolution for Generosity." In that article, Tom encourages us to try some new habits of generosity in the new year. And I loved it because it was such a fresh take, Tom. You got me to think in new ways, and I loved it. So thinking about generosity, have you ever thought that you could grow more generous by cutting other people a little more slack? Be generous by giving people more slack. Be generous by giving yourself some more slack. I love that one, and I'm going to practice that one. Practice random acts of kindness at least a few times a day, not like once a month or once a year, a few times a day. What would that look like? Practice generosity by giving of your financial resources. Of course, I would list giving to your church top on the list, but Tom didn't go there. Tom said, practice generosity by tipping big, by supporting a cause, by sharing things more freely, like those 5 coats in your closet that you haven't worn in 3.5 years. Guilty. The last one was, practice generosity by doing some community service anywhere. And I'm not going to say more because I want you to read Tom's article. It was inspiring for me. And if it's not in your email inbox, ask the office to send you another copy because you want to read it. To prepare ourselves for Jesus' coming, we can cultivate generous spirits within ourselves as a beginning to receive what Jesus brings. But we still need the Messiah. Our preparations, our efforts aren't enough because no matter how hard we try, our human abilities will fall short. We cannot do it on our own. No court can satisfy our longings for a good life, a whole life. Even the plaintiff's attorney in our trial acknowledged that our human forms of justice are imperfect. There's no way to compensate for the loss of a human life or limb or mobility, no matter how hard we try. Even when we try, we're fallible. Our jury, we as jurors, listening to hour after hour after hour of testimony, really getting to know our plaintiffs and their case, in the end, finally really didn't know the plaintiffs' hearts. Were they being honest with us? Or were they just trying to make a quick buck because the opportunity presented itself with this accident that happened to them? None of us have purely honest motives. None of us. And sadly, no one in the end can call us to account except God. And what does God do? God sends his son, the Messiah, to begin his ministry with his baptism in the Jordan. And when Jesus steps into the water to be baptized, God couldn't be more pleased because in so doing, God knows Jesus is claiming his mission as the Messiah come to reconcile a world that cannot reconcile itself. And because God's generous spirit rules this world, the Messiah comes not to preside over a court where we will be found guilty, lacking, owing, but where we will be forgiven, where our relationships will be repaired, and where we will be restored to right relationship, not only with one another, but with God. So, as you celebrate your baptism today, and I hope you will go home and eat a piece of cake, ask yourself, am I prepared? Am I ready to join Jesus in his mission of generosity and reconciliation? Am I ready to join Jesus in the mission that will change the world?